Well, I'm very glad to give a talk here. It's probably been a while since I've actually done anything but introduce speakers and made toasts and stuff like that in this room. Wearing one of my hats, however, I would like to officially make this, as all of my talks this year, part of the American Physical Society's centennial celebration, and remind you that it is indeed the 100th anniversary of the American Physical Society, and that within a couple of weeks, or less than 3 weeks, we are having a huge centennial bash party, mega conference for us in Atlanta, and I hope that a number of the folks here are going to get there, because it ought to be fun. Well, what I want to do today is to talk about a subject that has been engaging my attention for a number of years now. It's part of the whole area of solid mechanics. And the main theme of, well, there are a couple of main themes of what I want to say. One is that this is an area in which there are a number of extremely profound non-equilibrium physics problems that, as you'll see, I don't know how to solve. Actually, I noticed that there are some real experts in the room. I see Glenn Beltz and Bob McMeeking, and maybe they should leave now before they find out too many of the mistakes that I'm making, but I've actually learned an awful lot from them and a number of other people over the years. There is a second theme that I think is very important, and that's that although this is a field in which there has been an enormous amount of extremely good, scholarly, practical, insightful work done over about a century at least, that some of the main questions, in my opinion, haven't yet or are just being asked. And this is not in any way to say that they should have been asked, because I think that in a deep way, the tools for answering those questions were not available until just about now. And one of the main tools for looking for answers for those questions, as I would hope to point out to you, is what has amazed me as the remarkable power of the computer that has gone, sort of grown exponentially over the years and in recent years, and is now at a point where, in my opinion, you can actually use numerical simulation as a research tool, more or less on a par, if you do it right, with real theory and real experiment. It isn't real theory, it isn't real experiment, but it's the kind of a tool that produces qualitatively new kinds of information. And I'd like to give you just some sense of how I think that that is making a big impact in this classical field. Well, to start, just for the hell of it, I picked out an old picture. I hope everybody can see what that is. It's spilt milk. And in a way, it illustrates a whole lot of the kinds of things that I want to talk about, and brings to mind the idea that one of the things that we're doing in non-equilibrium physics these days, and one of the things that the computer is allowing us to do, is to look at very, very familiar phenomena. Phenomena that have been practically important ever since the dawn of history, as a matter of fact. And to turn our understanding of those things into bringing much more deep scientific principles into it. Spilled milk also suits my state of mind about this, because it's been a frustrating field to work in. I thought that I've made some of the things that I thought I was actually doing that were important haven't turned out to be so important. And what I want to show you now are a few things that I'm very optimistic about this week, And in principle, I wanted to mention, and I want to just go back to here and mention that a lot of what I'm going to talk about is based on Mike Falk's thesis that he finished last summer. So it's work that Mike, who's now at Harvard, has an awful lot of the work that he's done. And at the very beginning, I'd also like to mention that a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about is stuff that I've discussed in great detail, and a lot of the ideas have come from work with Alex Lobkowski here, and also discussions with Sharad Ramanathan and Dan Rabinowitz and company. Okay, here's
Jim, you showed us spilled milk because you're going to do turbulence as well?
Only in a psychological sense. Okay. All right, now here's a picture of a crack that is the one that I want you to keep in your mind throughout almost everything that I'm going to say. This is one of Mike Falk's early sort of exploratory attempts to make a crack in a molecular dynamics simulation of an amorphous material. And I'll say more about why we want to talk about amorphous materials in just a minute or two. But what Mike has done here, this is just a close-up picture of something of the order of 100,000 molecules on a computer in a two-dimensional array. There is a large number of different sizes and quenched to make it a nice glassy material. And what he's done is he's done a classic fracture experiment. Namely, he's grabbed the outside of this material. He's made a notch in it on one side. He's pulled the thing apart on the computer and watched the crack move through. And what you're looking at here is the tip of that crack. This is, in fact, a brittle crack for reasons that we can talk about in a moment. But you can actually see at the tip of that crack exactly where those molecules are moving around, and that's the main point of what I want to say. We'll come back to this picture in a minute, but I want you to just think about the structure around it. It looks very ragged. You can see molecules being pulled apart, little voids being formed as that crack goes through. But for all intents and purposes, if you looked at this in real life, you would think this was a brittle crack and it was zipping through that material at something like a sound speed.
So the formation of those lakes is somehow non-local?
Well, yeah, the whole region around the tip of that crack is pulling apart in an interesting way.
You put in some and potential.
In fact, in this case, it's just a simple Lennard-Jones potential. The color scheme, as you can see up there, is that it's being pulled apart here, and here where it's both pink and blue, is, you know, the stresses have relaxed. You'll see some better pictures of how you interpret that in just a minute. Now, here's the transparency. Where I'll start attracting the tomatoes from the solid mechanics experts in the class, in the room. I want to emphasize a number of questions about fracture, but I would like to emphasize one in particular. On the first transparency, in fact, I zipped through it because I mentioned that one of the things that I have talked about here in recent years, this question of why these cracks go on unstable, zigzaggy trajectories. That's an instability that I think is still not really understood. We're making some progress, perhaps. But I would like to point your attention to what I consider now an even deeper puzzle, and one that in particular McMeeking and Belts have paid a lot of attention to. That's why I'm expecting the rotten tomatoes. Namely, it illustrates something that I think that goes very deep. Namely, that we know that materials will deform plastically. Even very rigid, brittle materials, eventually the molecules will start exchanging places, and the material will deform usually at stresses which are less than the stresses at which they'll break. That's a sort of a general principle. Now, that we know also, we look around the tip of a crack, and this is my caricature of that picture that you just saw. We look around the tip of the crack, we know there are stresses being applied on the outside. We know that those stresses are greatly amplified near the crack tip. It's the lightning rod effect. You know, we're solving a Laplace equation, not quite, but it's something like that. So we know that the whole reason that cracks behave like this is that I can apply relatively mild forces to the outside of the material, and those forces, the stresses, will be concentrated at the sharp tip of a crack, and you'll have breaking occur. However, the paradox is that because this material will also undergo plastic deformation near that crack tip, what we know is that something around that crack tip, most likely, not always, if it's going along a lattice plane or something like that, it can do something different, but certainly in an amorphous material like this, what we would expect would be that the material would in an intuitive sense, it would soften, that it would bend irreversibly or something like that. And the standard understanding is that I can't have stresses, the material can't support stresses that are greater than some sort of a plastic yield stress. So there have been a lot of efforts been made for at least a decade, perhaps considerably longer, to try to figure out what's happening near a crack tip that can allow breaking stresses to be transmitted through a plastic zone near the crack tip and therefore allow the crack to propagate in a brittle way, technically speaking. One of the most active areas of investigation at the moment is what's sometimes called the strain gradient theory, and Mike Ashby, Norman Fleck, John Hutchinson, actually Tony Evans, who's here, who used to be here, has worked an awful lot on that. And it's a relatively recent thing, and what the idea is that I have a lot of strains and strain gradients. The strains are changing and rapidly as a function of position in the neighborhood of the crack tip. That means that there have to be dislocations, either generated or just sitting there, that are in that neighborhood. And if enough dislocations get in there, they get tangled up like my mental image is that it looks a little bit like the famous vortex glass that others of you know about. And as that somehow rigidifies or hardens the material near the crack tip. Johnny?
Can you maybe, for us non-experts, back up a little bit and give us a rough overview? Because I sort of tend to think of that there are many different kinds of solids.
Yeah.
And they're very different, like chalk, iron, piece of paper, and so on. And this, your theory only, maybe you can tell us what stuff this theory.
Well, I haven't given you a theory yet. In fact, this picture that I'm talking about presumably applies to any solid.
Any solid. So
and that's just exactly the point I want to make next, Tony. Well, there's a fibrous kind of a thing, and when Ed Kramer here breaks his polymers, he makes crazes and stuff like that. Let's talk about materials that are holding together by relatively short-range forces, and we can talk about what happens in some of those other special cases. There are many. This explanation of why stresses can propagate through to a crack tip applies to only to a crystal, because it's only in the case of a crystal that I can talk about dislocations. And I don't want to try to give a course on dislocations, but you have a general idea of dislocations are where the lattice planes are coming a cropper and not quite matching up with each other, and they move around, and that's supposedly what explains plasticity in crystalline solids. And indeed, it is what explains plasticity in crystalline solids, in the sense that we can then understand something about the energetics of how things bend. But the point is that we know perfectly well that all of those same things happen in a non-crystalline solid, where I can't talk about dislocations. That if I did this experiment, and people are doing it, in a silicate glass, or in plexiglass, in a plastic kind of material, or if I did it in an amorphous metal, that the same phenomena occur. We know plasticity occurs. We know we can have brittle fracture. We know we can have ductile fracture. And therefore, this idea, it has some other weaknesses, which I argue with these people about, but I don't want to take time to talk about that here. This idea cannot be a general explanation for how those stresses can really come and break bonds between molecules at a crack tip. I want to mention one other recent attempt, which I think is extremely beautiful, by Ben Friend and John Hutchinson, who are simply, they did a very nice calculation, and they noticed that, if I have plasticity, and the reason that I can't allow a stress higher than a yield stress is that the thing will start flowing, but it'll flow at a certain rate, and I'm going to say something about that in just a second. And therefore, if the crack goes through very fast, it can't produce that much deformation, and therefore maybe I can have a reasonable kind of behavior. This thing also has a problem, however. It has a deep problem in that it necessarily predicts, for reasons that we could go into, that the slower the crack goes, the more energy per unit crack advance is going to have to be spent to make the thing go. And that seems to be inconsistent, so far as I can tell, with experimental data. Let me amplify these points, because I need to do that, just briefly, by saying something about plasticity. I didn't want to study plasticity when I got into this business. I didn't think I had to, and it's really only in the last year that I have been trapped into trying to understand plasticity. And there is another topic for which there is a huge literature. It's an extremely technical topic.
How the non-experts like myself, even plasticity is...
I'm even going to bend this thing a little bit for you.
What about chalk? Granular material.
Chalk, in fact, but a much more delicate way. The chalk is going to be intrinsically very brittle, and I'm going to have to measure it very carefully to understand that I'll have some kind of plasticity. But again, that's done, those kinds of experiments, not exactly chalk, but in Fred Lang's group here, where he puts ceramic powders together and compactifies it, he makes a material that looks as if it has to be absolutely brittle and it looks like chalk, and then if he makes the material in one way, it turns out, yes, it is brittle, and if he makes the material in another way, it turns out to be completely ductile. Okay, so you're going to have to give me a moment to explain that, but this is what I want to try to do here. I want to try to appeal to your intuition and remind. So think about what you're doing here. I'm thinking about applying some sort of a stress and measuring a strain. I really want to think about a shear stress, but it's perfectly good just to think that I have this metal piece here, and I'm not really going to do it because I'd mess myself up. But you can just use your intuition to think, okay, suppose that I hold it here and I pull. That's applying a kind of a stress, okay? So I pull, and if I pull a little bit, it just behaves irreversibly. It's elastic, and it comes back to where it wants to be before. And so there's the standard Hooke's law stress strain curve right at the beginning. Okay. Now you all know, and this is what I don't want to do. If I pull a little bit harder, I bend it. Right. The thing undergoes an unrecoverable amount of deformation, and that's what I'll see is that I pull a bit harder, it starts going like that, and if I release it, instead of it coming right back to where it was before, here I'm lowering I'm just releasing it so the stress goes back down to zero, it comes to a place with a finite deformation, finite strain. Okay. Now, this also should be pretty close to your to your intuition, because I could then think about taking this thing, and now you have to imagine my pointer as having been bent. Okay, it's bent and it's hanging there in an unhappy state. Now if I put the stress back on, it just behaves as if in the same direction. In other words, it's bent, and it has only relaxed a little bit. If I take the stress back on, it goes back to where it was before. It behaves as if it's perfectly elastic up to there. So a pretty good approximation. On the other hand, and I didn't draw this here, I probably should have, if I put the stress on in the opposite direction, suppose that I have it bent, and I push it this way, I'll bend it back. Okay? So that this system, this bit of cheap metal, of whatever it is, or almost any other solid that you can think of, when I've done this thing, I've put a permanent strain in it, it remembers that it has had that strain. So I can come back here, and it will behave differently if I put this next strain in that direction than if I put it in that direction. Okay? There's a very important class of phenomena that basically have no explanation. If you look at the most recent textbooks on plasticity, they will give you rules for drawing these curves or deducing them from experiment, and then will tell you how to use those rules in a calculation for computing whether your airplane wing is going to fall off. They give you very little hint of an underlying, even a phenomenological theory of something like that. I'm breaking a symmetry in the material by applying an irreversible strain. There's something in that material that remembers what's happening. Now, I've put down here also that what you can think about is, like, you get up to some place where basically this curve is leveling off for reasons that I don't understand. That's called hardening. And beyond that point, and I just draw it as a dotted line, there's some sort of a plastic yield stress. Beyond that point, what I really should be thinking about is plotting not the stress as a function of strain, but the stress as a function of strain rate. So that if I apply a big enough stress, the thing will just, in fact, flow. And that's, in fact, what that second idea of what was going on at the crack tip had to do with, is that it's saying, okay, you can move out into here in some way near a crack tip as long as you don't stay there for very long, as long as the crack goes flying by. And that, I think, has a piece of the truth to it. Okay, those are the concepts that I need. Now I want to get on to back to some of the stuff that Mike Falk and I did. Here's another one of his early fracture experiments, in quotes, on the computer. In fact, this was the first one. What he did was, just as I said, he started actually in this case with just a straight line crack in there, and then he pulled, and instead of the thing going forward the way the other one did, it just sort of blunted. It opened out like that. One of those voids that you saw ahead of the previous picture, instead of just sort of closing up or being gobbled up by the crack or left behind by the crack, it started opening up, and then you saw it merged with this thing, and the whole business then sort of went ahead in jumps and starts. It was more like a tearing behavior than a brittle cracking behavior, and this is what's called a ductal crack. The initial condition, basically all he did was he took a line of these molecules and disconnected them from each other, so that that's where the thing would start.
You notice in this contrast, the previous case, there are much fewer lakes and there are no lakes. The lakes are very small.
Yeah, in this particular picture, that's true. And if I get to it at the end of the talk, I'll show you some other pictures that where there's a much better diagnostic about what's going on. No, they both have the same initial conditions. These are two different materials. And what's interesting is that it was this material that was made by a standard prescription for interactions between Leonard Jones molecules that had been studied in the literature to get, you know, thermal properties, thermodynamic properties of what of glasses. And we thought for sure it would be brittle. This was done essentially at zero temperature, and it wasn't brittle. And it was Fred Lang who showed us how to change the interaction so that we got the other picture in some subtle way that changed it from being brittle, from being ductile to brittle. At that point, what we realized was that we really didn't know what the hell was going on. So what we tried to do then was to do some controlled, I should call it engineering experiments. By the way, I should mention that we wanted particularly to do amorphous materials because we didn't want to get into this complicated dislocation theory. We thought that and all of the relatively simple theoretical concepts that we'd been playing with didn't have any reference to the crystalline axes and a number of other reasons. Also, all the best experiments had been done with amorphous materials. So what we decided to do was not to look at fracture at all, but to look to see how an amorphous material would behave under the simplest possible stressing and straining circumstances. We just took a block of this stuff, applied what's called simple or pure shear to the material, so that basically you're trying to, you know, shearing it, you're essentially elongating it in this direction and compressing it in that direction. We used a two-component Leonard Jones kind of two-dimensional system, again, to try to get the simplest possible thing. It's the same two-component system that had been studied with other people who were doing quasicrystals. Five of the big molecules just fit nicely around a small one, and 10 of the small ones fit nicely around a big one, and it doesn't like to form a nice, perfect crystal. If you do it very, very carefully, of course, you can make it into a quasicrystal, but we didn't want to do that. So what we did was we simply did some nice shearing experiments in as controlled a fashion as we possibly could. Here's another picture of precisely that same system, but here's the real thing. It's not even a very big one. We didn't need to use such big samples as we needed to try to get cracks propagating through. And you can see it's being deformed a little bit. This is actually to scale, so we have a few percent shear strain on the thing. And I'm going to tell you what the red spots are in just a little while, because the red spots are Mike's diagnostic for where irreversible in fact, non-affine deformations are occurring. And that was the clue to the whole business. But let me first show you the experimental results. Experiment in quotes. Now, this picture isn't quite as hard to understand as it looks at first glance. What we did was we plotted stress up this axis, shear strain up that axis, but in units, so because we had measured the shear modulus of this material, so that we measure these in units so that the stress and the strain would fall on top of each other if, in fact, there was perfectly elastic behavior. This is as time, and what we did, Michael did, was we just would ramp the stress up. We're controlling the stress and we're measuring the strain. So you ramp the stress up to some value, that's bending this thing, you're holding it, and then you just hold it. Okay? And if you look at the blue curve down here, what you see is that this actual stress is the dot, so you ramp it up, and the stress and the strain just immediately follow each other, and there's nothing very interesting. If you look at the green curve, the stress goes up to here, but the strain gets up a little bit higher, but just levels off. You get some fixed strain. The yellow curve starts getting more interesting. Here we're getting up to a higher stress, so the stress is just held constant there, but now look at the strain. The strain comes up a little bit faster and takes over a long, long time, and then finally levels off at a particular value. And finally, the red curves, I've got the stress up to something that we have to identify as being above some sort of a yield stress, and now notice what happens. The thing just goes, keeps on going. I apply enough stress that now the response of the material is that I get a strain rate. It just flows under the influence of the stress. So there's a lot of detailed information that you can get out of this. Here's another graph. Here we controlled the strain. In fact, we just ramped up the strain as a function of time and watched how the stress was going to behave. And it does just the kind of thing that I was showing you on that rough graph. It comes up, it first starts as if it's looking as if it's just behaving elastically, but it bends over, and in the real experiment it has some jiggles and jags, which are, I think, quite interesting, but we'll get to that. Let me show you what I think is the most interesting experiment that we did. Here, what we did was we put a stress history on this thing. We ramped the stress up to something below this yield stress and held it for a finite time and then released it. So here the blue curve is we held it for a finite time and it came to some strain, but obviously it is bent. Okay. Now we do the same thing that I mentioned in that graph. The red curve, we release the stress and it comes back down. There's a little loop in here which we could talk about. But then if we go back up, it just basically it cycles up along there as if it was elastic, just as the way we were talking about this thing behaving. But if we come back down here and now reverse the stress along this green curve, it starts tracing out a hysteresis loop. So this simple two-dimensional Lennard-Jonesium thing has its memory. It remembers when it's here. That if it goes that way, if it's stressed that way, it's supposed to behave elastically. If it's stressed that way, it's supposed to behave plastically.
Can you bring it down to back to A?
Yeah. Yeah, you can recycle it and do things like that. You start working the hysteresis loop into a new shape after a while. But that's what happens if I do it with this thing, too. So there's a quite an interesting set of behavior there. All right, so far we've done experiments with the computer. We haven't learned anything other than the fact that what we can do with the computer is we can reproduce laboratory experiments with certain kinds of interactions between the particles. And that, as I say, is not enough for 1999. Let me show you what's happening in a little bit more detail. I wish I had this picture in color, but I don't. What we can do with the computer that you can't do with real experiments, at least not so far as I know, is you can see where these molecules are going. And now, Michael invented an absolutely beautiful way of getting the computer to tell him, me too, where there were local spots in this material that were undergoing non-affine transformations, where the molecules were reorganizing themselves in ways that can't be described by a simple strain tensor. It's utterly trivial, and again, I can tell you more about that, but I would like to get to some other points. So, and you can sort of see what's happening. Here's one case. The oval is just drawn to aid the eye, but you're supposed to look at, for example, this group of four molecules in there, and what you notice is you've stretched it in that direction, compressed it in that direction under the shear transformation, and basically this molecule has moved in between those two and has become a nearest neighbor of this big one, so that and these two have moved out of the way.
That's two different kinds of molecules. That's just for each of.
No, I have to have two different kinds of molecules in order for this thing not to just immediately form a lattice.
Oh, I see.
Okay, in order to get it to make to be a non-crystalline, that has to have two different kinds of molecules. So that's, in fact, we gave this a name. We call it shear transformation zones, and we can then just follow what's going on in this material. by getting the computer to show us where the shear where the shear transformation zones are, when they show up and at what time. So here's one of those runs. The time units are in basically molecular vibration time. So all of this stuff happens very fast. And so you see that after 10 time units, looking at the displacement after 10 time units, you get those sorts of blotches. If you look at the whole transformation after 30 time units, you begin to see a pattern of these things. In fact, they seem to be clustering together in interesting ways, which we've not yet explored. This is that same run, except that what we've done here was we've just marked the places of the non-affine transformations in the last one time unit before this happened. So you can sort of see just that they're coming up at roughly a uniform rate. They're not all going at the same time. The more interesting thing is that here, this picture corresponds to that one, starting with precisely the same configuration of the molecules. Again, that's one of the things you can do with a computer, is you can you know exactly where every single molecule is, so you can make the same precise same sample and do a different experiment on it and see what happens. Here, all we did was we did the experiment, except we applied the shear in the opposite direction. So that if you look at it, in fact, you can actually see that this one, well, not when I projected, this one is sheared more like stretching this way and compressing that way, whereas this one goes in the opposite direction. This is the same time interval as that. It looks qualitatively the same, but if you look at it in more detail, what you see is that there are different places that have lit up. The shear transformation zones have been activated in different places. Well, this then immediately gave us an idea of how to make a theory of this. And now I get to some theory. So far I've been only experimental. Roughly speaking, what we're thinking of is that we have places in the material where the stuff has maybe a little bit of extra free volume, something like that. Somehow they're weaker. But we can think of the simplest possible clusters of four molecules that could, under one configuration, look like that. But if I just make this simple change of nearest neighbor, interacting molecules, it would go like that. And now you immediately begin to see one of the crucial aspects of this, is that once I've made this transformation, so I've sheared it, this particular zone in one direction, I can't do it again. It's jammed in that direction. I can make it go back, but I can't move it indefinitely in that direction. So that what you can see is happening in this material is that as you shear it in one direction, you flip all of the little zones that you have available to it, and then it jams. So this is a concept, by the way, I'm using. We had this ITP program on jamming and rheology just last year. So you can immediately see why you might get some sort of asymmetry. So the next trick, of course, and now you get into some really non-trivial statistical mechanics. All these experiments are done at essentially zero temperature. You had to control the temperature a little bit. We did it at 1/3 of 1% of the nominal glass transition temperature for this. So, Tony, yeah.
Sorry. If you start with some initial configuration of all the molecules, right, and you go around drawing these blue ovals, aren't there a lot of molecules that are sort of left out?
Extremely good question. One of the things that we don't know how to do a priori is to just look at a picture and identify which are the places that are going to be weak and are going to transform. Although we have some ideas about how to do that. It's obviously a little bit more complicated than just looking at little quartets of molecules.
So what do you do with the...
Well, look, let me show you how we try to make a description of this. The first thing that we have to do is to decide on some sort of a rate factor for making these transitions. And so our idea was to make it like a thermally activated rate, except that we don't have any temperature. The only thing that we have in this system are fluctuations in the local free volume. So basically, it's not our idea. It goes back to Turnbull and Cohen and Ali-Argon, that you have something like an energy is the equivalent of an energy, a free energy is something like extra volume that you need in order to make the switch go. But that volume is going to depend on how much the thing has been deformed elastically. And the thing that's analogous to a temperature is the average free volume in the system. Actually, there are some sort of hand-waving statistical mechanics arguments that you can make for doing things like this, and we put some of that in our paper, but that's a problem that is nowhere near solved. So we tried to start out with some idea of a rate at which I make these transformations, and then we simply wrote some equations of motion for this thing, where if I say that n plus or minus is the number of zones per unit volume, and then I write an equation of motion for this that says that the rate at which I go from n minus to n plus is this, and similarly I have a rate for going from n plus to n minus. We added to this, and this has turned out to be absolutely crucial, a rate at which I could annihilate the zones. And what we said was that that rate is going to be proportional to the rate at which I'm doing plastic work on the thing. It seems to be a reasonable assumption. And then, of course, you also want a rate at which you can create new zones. So if you're doing work, plastic work, and you're rearranging the thing, it seems logical that you'd be creating new places where I could have some flipping occurring. The inelastic shear strain, that's the amount of deformation, so that you have a rate at which you're doing that, which is just the rate at which I'm flipping in one direction minus the rate at which I'm flipping in the other direction. It doesn't take, these are not very sophisticated equations. There's no.
So it's very nonlinear, that, right?
That's right.
It's like the bottom equation.
The whole thing, in fact, is extremely nonlinear.
Explain why you take some of those coefficients and you pull the outlines of
this. Well, because I have to have some sort of, I have to assume some sort of detailed balance kind of equation, that there has to be a symmetry, that I don't want to build any extra asymmetry into the problem. That one, I think, is not a problem.
But at this point, is it easy to go back and say, suppose I had a crystal, so I know exactly what I'm doing, could you give me a moment? Tell me how what this means in a crystal.
Well, you're jumping ahead. I have a picture later on, in fact, almost next, that will show you what I think is happening in a crystal. I think in a crystal, I have to think about dislocations and defects, and the way the dislocations will pile up anisotropically around a defect, I think will have precisely the same features. But we had to see this jumping out at us from the computer experiments before we could realize how to make a theory like this. Let me show you what this theory does. Yeah, Doug? There's this R. The R's that I wrote here depend in an extremely nonlinear way on the applied stress. And that's, of course, one of the variables. But even here, if I look at what's happening in these terms, you'll see that I have that the rate at which the plastic work is being done has the applied stress in it. It has this whole rate that sits there times the number of zones that are there, so that it's a nonlinear term of even in a simple approximation. Let me show you a simple approximation to it where I forget about all the nonlinearity and that activated rate function. This is something that Alex and I have played with, and so it has no memory effects. But you can immediately see how using this sort of a formalism, where basically what I've introduced is, in this case, is just one sort of extra variable that we call delta, that describes the internal state of this system, and it's of course going to have a very important dynamical role. So delta is the excess of the plus zones to the minus zones, assuming it really has to be a tensor. I don't want to do that, certainly not for a colloquium. And so I have a rate equation that says that the plastic strain rate is just proportional to, well, to the stress applied, but minus delta, because if delta is too big, then I don't have any more zones left and I can't make the transformations. And then I have to figure out how delta changes, and well, it's obviously going to just be the leading part of it is that it's, as I make the switches, I'm making the strains. But now I have to put in these annihilation and creation terms, and they show up like this. And here's that nonlinearity that we were talking about. And now I can actually do a sort of a flow diagram. This isn't I'm not plotting the flows, I'm just plotting that where epsilon dot equals zero is when delta equals lambda s, it's a curve like this. When delta dot equals zero, obviously epsilon dot equals zero means that delta dot will vanish, but when delta dot vanishes but epsilon dot doesn't vanish, I have a curve that looks like this. These are lines of stable fixed points. So that I know that my system will always just approach those fixed points if I keep it nice and uniform. So if I'm below this place where there's an intersection, and that intersection is indeed the yield stress, I will get exactly the kind of behavior that we saw happening. But in fact, I can also show that if I plot the final deformation strain as a function of the stress, it will bend over like that. That's a little bit like the stress strain curve, except that what from here we see is the very dynamical thing. It also happens to take a long time as I get up to that yield stress. If I look here to a good approximation, so that when my stress is above the yield stress, that tells me that I have a strain rate that shows up. And so this curve looks qualitatively like that time-dependent, rate-dependent kind of plasticity. And you can also see, I mean, here's just a schematic, and this is a picture that Phil was about to ask me about, that where the memory effects are going to be, is that basically if I put those rate factors back in, I have to switch. I switch from one to the other. I probably should have drawn another picture here that showed when the two minima are just equal to each other. And then the point is that as long as I don't have a very high temperature, I can't jump from one to another. These things can't switch their orientations very easily unless they're activated in some way. And here's this shear transformation zone model, which I showed you before, and jumping back and forth is equivalent to this. And my guess is that when you look at crystalline materials, you get a pile up of dislocations around any kind of a defect, an impurity, a grain boundary. And I can switch it to that orientation, but presumably it jams if I get it too far. On the other hand, if I'm above some yield stress and I start being able to create and annihilate zones that look like this or the other, then eventually I will get to a stress, as we saw before, where I'm switching at the same rate, I'm creating new ones and I can keep the thing whole flowing. All of this comes out of this extremely simple picture. And now, let me just show you a few ways in which, actually, it was some sweat. They're not a trivial number. Not only not too few parameters here, but there are a number of parameters that came into this thing. And at first, we were afraid it was going to be too easy to fit those parameters because we had too many of them. And then we were afraid we started looking at it, because it was a really very rich set of data that was coming out of this, that we didn't have enough and that, that we were going to falsify all possible versions of this theory. And then there were some surprises because, you know, we thought that we were trying various, we had various ideas set in our minds about where the important defects should be, and they weren't there. They were other places, and we can get into that. But you know, here's, this was the two experiments of two different strain rates coming along there, and you watch the stress move up. And we, with the parameters that we were able to fix, here's the theory. It even has this sort of interesting bump in it here. The main bumpiness there has to do with, I think, the fact that these zones are forming and jamming it up, and then you finally get enough stress and they break up.
How many parameters?
Oh, six, I think.
Six.
So that we can count. But,
do you think those bumps smoothed out because of the 3D?
I did it a bigger system in any case, probably 3D for sure. Those bumps would indeed be a lot smoother, you know. Although not necessarily. In fact, I was just talking to Bill Nix from Stanford a few weeks ago, and he's doing experiments on metallic glasses, and he gets a. He's seeing a bumpiness like that too. That has some qualitative features. That it looks as if what happens is it releases, and then it behaves as if it's elastically expanding for a while. Here's the way the. I'm sorry. Yeah. Here's a. I just did a rough. Graph. You know, we get with all of the same six parameters. You know, we actually get this kind of behavior. The thing, the theory was really cycles. It doesn't have this extra little loop. And but as far as I was concerned, that was a really pretty good. You know, agreement. Here's another set of tests that we made where we actually turned the stress on. It's like that first transparency that I showed. Turned the stress up, but then and then let it down. And so you can see this time constant diverging as that it takes, you know, at very small stress, which is basically elastic. You know, it's a little bit of inelastic behavior, but not much. Go up a little bit further and it takes a longer time to reach its equilibrium. Go up further and it takes a much longer time to reach its equilibrium. We don't quite get the inelastic relaxation right. Okay, I would like to take the last 5 minutes to talk to get it back to fracture. And here's a picture I sort of promised I would show you. Here's this diagnostic with this the shear transformation zones showing up as the non-affine rearrangements, at least on the right. And the picture on the left is the standard one where we're basically just showing the hydrostatic stress on it. And so you can see that it's you know, got a negative pressure in there, tensile stress, and that's relieved as the crack moves. But much more interesting, what you can see is that here's this crack moving ahead, and here are those shear transformation zones turning blue. And this is the brittle crack. Obviously, there's a good deal of plastic deformation that's occurring, and in fact, along lines where the shear stress is larger. But most of it is, in fact, showing up at the tip of the crack. And so the question is, can I bring this back to understanding, since we seem to be understanding dynamic plastic deformation in a better way, can I bring it back to understanding what's going on in your crack tips? And this is brand new, and I thought I had it right for every other week in the last several months. And I think I have it right now. And I'm starting to write a paper again, but I may be still wrong. I'm getting that look from Alex here. But one of the hypothesis I want to explore is that in, at least in some materials, in some circumstances, that even what looks like a brittle crack, the way it advances could be governed by something like plastic deformation going on at the crack tip. So it looks like it's happening in those pictures. Even the very first picture that I showed you looks as if, you know, those molecules are rearranging themselves in a way that's consistent with some sort of plastic deformation at the crack tip. Now, what that would mean would be that we should not do fracture dynamics the way I and most of my colleagues have been doing it for the last 50 years, assuming that a crack is an absolutely sharp object that produces a stress singularity at its tip. That what we should be doing is thinking of the tip of the crack as itself being a dynamical object with one of the important dynamical degrees of freedom is the radius of curvature, that crack tip. Let me draw a qualitative picture. And by the way, I should say that Glenn Beltz has got some very interesting independent ideas along these lines. Glenn, you're going to talk about these in a few weeks at our Tuesday seminar. The calculation that I've been trying to do in a way that I believe is basically that. We think about a crack tip. We have some radius of curvature at the crack tip. We have some plastic deformation. Presumably has to be described by something like the shear transformation zone model with some extra degree of freedom that's sitting there. Hopefully we can reduce that to something that's manageable in for at least some simple analytic estimates. And what we need to do is see, okay, what stresses are being imposed there that are driving the plastic deformation, already a non-trivial business, highly technical thing having to do with compatibility relationships that I wish I had never heard about, but I have to. So that I want some equation of motion, not just for the speed at which the tip is moving, as a function of that radius of curvature, and I'm putting sigma infinity, some measure of the driving force. Technically, it should be the stress intensity factor. But then I should have another equation of motion for the radius of curvature. And I've made a whole bunch of approximations, and there's one that I think, you know, they all look pretty much the same. And so I think there's probably something like right, where I can do a calculation having gotten back in the clutches of Mishkelishvili and maybe gotten out of them with all kinds of work in the complex plane, where rho dot as a function of rho is a decreasing function that goes through zero, that there's another, some sort of a stable fixed point for that behavior. And then, of course, if I plot the tip velocity at that fixed point, it has a nice rising behavior. There's no analog of any kind of minimum or divergence of zero velocity, things of that sort.
Is this easy to understand?
Well, I think it's to understand that in fact that the result of the calculation will have that structure. I can wave my hand, and I think I could even convince you that you understood it, but I'd be not. I'd be a charlatan if I tried to do that. I think that, in fact, it's rather subtle, that there are a number of extremely subtle points that are coming in here, like how you get the energy balance, how you understand what the effect of the surface tension, which is produced by the extra surface energy that you're producing.
Are you going to tell us about the lakes? At some point, I mean, in this picture, that corresponds to that.
Well, look, let's go back to that picture. So way back to that very first picture of Mike Falk's brittle crack in an amorphous material. And what you're seeing is that there's obviously some kind of sensitivity, so very great sensitivity, probably in view of other experiences and instability of this thing, that it doesn't like to go along a straight line. It looks as if it might, you know, be wanting to send off a crack branch, and in fact I can show you pictures of the actual experiments that when cracks become unstable, what they're doing is they're branching off and making a complicated some array of damage in front of them. But look, this is a very preliminary, small scale, not terribly well controlled numerical experiment.
So you're saying those lakes want to come back now?
This stuff here I would think of as basically just a symptom of the fact that I'm getting a lot of plastic deformation in that whole region around the crack tip. But I wouldn't try to interpret this too seriously at all, because this, remember that one of the things that happens in a numerical experiment, especially if you don't have a huge supercomputer, is that even in a system as simple as this, what you're doing is you're putting on extremely high strain rates. Because you know, you just don't have time to let things, you know, adjust very slowly.
But this instability in this direction is not in that theory on the last transparency.
No.
Right?
No. I thought it was in other talks that I've given around here, but I'm not so sure. That instability has a lot of other features to it, probably having to do with the way the shear stresses transform and in moving frames that are going at close to the sound speed. And at the moment I don't want to draw too much from this picture at all, other than the sort of qualitative idea that, look, that crack tip has a lot of structure. It's not just finding the places where it can break bonds between these molecules and moving through on some sort of an atomic scale. Even this thing that is clearly a brittle crack is in fact putting a lot of structure and dynamics at that crack tip. Jim?
If the crack tip is governed by plasticity, why is it so hard to compare to ceramic? It looks like a very plastic stuff.
Well, saran wrap has a. I should ask Ed Kramer that question. He's the expert on plastic deformation and breaking is sitting here. But my guess is that what you're seeing in saran wrap is a highly nonlinear, basically elastic kind of deformation, and indeed. Is that right, Ed?
Saran wrap actually has a crystalline structure on a very small scale. So it doesn't really show up in terms of scattered light. And the chains are oriented sort of in the plane of the crack, that's the way it's laid. And under those circumstances, because you have to break the way that the crack to go, you have to break a lot of covalent bonds. It's actually very difficult to do that relative to, for example, shear or parallel to these questions. I think that's a simple thing.
Yeah. But basically, I'm not talking here about a material where I have long chains whose lengths are large compared to the scale of the damage that I'm doing. I'm finished. I should have made a...
Question back on.
To what extent does your sensitivity knowledge explain fatigue of reactions?
Explain fatigue? It's beginning to get there. Because, look, what's happening is that as I work the metal, you saw already it's starting to get a hysteresis curve. That curve will, in fact, start shifting around, both in the theory and the experiment. But, you know, we haven't really probed the theory enough to figure out whether we're getting that accurately. But what's absolutely clear is that, and one of the things that we really want to do is we want to try the full-blown STZ model, for just looking at a crack. And what's absolutely clear is that you're going to stress the material ahead of the crack, like this, but then it's going to be unloaded, unstressed behind the crack. It's going to come down, and it's going to be hardened, because it's going to remember that it was gone one way but it won't go the other way. So that there's a change in the material along the fracture phase, which is, of course, also what's seen experimentally. And that already is a rudimentary version of a fatiguing. That material will certainly have very different properties after the crack has gone through, both in the theory and the experiment. Again, these theoretical ideas are not more than a few months old. Let's see, there was a... So Mark had a question, then was it? Mark, you...
I have two questions. One of the external technique questions is, what sort of computer do you need to run these things on?
Well, the fracture stuff that I showed you was originally run on the Cornell Theory Center's computers of blessed memory. And some of the other stuff has been done on the parallel machine that lives in the MRL, but it's part of. But the relatively simple, just the plain old shear stuff, I think Mike just did this on his workstation. Is that there? That you saw, we weren't dealing with hundreds of thousands of molecules there. But to do the whole thing right, just because there's a whole lot of dynamics in there, and we want to be able to set the thing properly and look for steady states, is going to take what we now call a supercomputer.
Yeah. Question. How far can this go before you have to start worrying about quantum chemical bonding and so on, which is not really a
practical? I think it can go quite a long way, but not all the way. After all, if you want to talk about real cracks, it depends an awful lot about what chemicals are involved and come in and help breaking bonds and things like that.
There's a question by Ted.
Yeah.
Ted?
Well, you can run this at any temperature you like. It's you run the molecular dynamics with a nose thermostat on it, so that it basically fixes the temperature. At least that's the way we did the controlled shear things. The fracture ones, I don't think you want to do that, because after all, an important part of fracture dynamics is what happens to the energy that's released. So there's some very interesting questions about what physical models you want to use there.
The question will be here.
But
should we be thinking of those fluctuations as quantum
mechanics? No, I don't think so, Ted. I think that before we have to think about quantum mechanics in here, we'd better understand. After all, we could think of this material as being something like a loosely connected cement, and the same things happen. We do, in fact, that's a kind of experiment that's done, where you look at fracture, as I said, mentioning before, Fred Lyon's lab, where he looks at these ceramic powders that are compactified. So I don't think that the quantum mechanics is going to be important at this kind of analysis. It's obviously going to be very important if we want to do ab initio calculations of what the binding energies are, what the correlations are, what the stable configurations are in these materials.
Question over here.
I just wonder if along the crack you really have elevated temperature to such an extent that you are approaching the melting point. And maybe that is related to the time dependence, because this energy dissipates, and if you do it fast, then
Well, that is indeed one scenario that people have played with, but it certainly is not always true. In fact, in much of fracture dynamics, it looks as if you put the numbers in, you generate a lot of heat, and that heat stays there, but the tip is out there. Moving, not much affected by it.
I just don't understand the colored picture.
On this last picture?
For example, are they the colors in with
No. These colors are just to tell you the color scale, which didn't get plotted there. That blue is tells you that that's a region of large negative pressure, tensile stress. And the red is where it's under compression. So you see that it becomes sort of uniformly blue ahead of the crack, and then if the crack has relaxed the stresses, it's there are places where it's blue and places where it's pink. Yes, they do indeed flicker. Now when we do it with the shear transformations, and I don't have any color pictures of those at all. I should never have let Mike finish his thesis. what you can see are some slightly different things. But there, I think the grayscale was good enough to understand. What
I want to ask a question which may be outside the scope of your talk. Which is, do people know how things scale? And let me tell you what I have in mind. We can all tear a piece of paper, mm-hmm. but when I was an undergraduate, right, the strong guys would entertain us by tearing phone books going around.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, how does it scale with the number of sheets that you see? I mean, it seems to go up exponentially, right? Tear some three
exponentially?
Sheets. I mean, it seems to go up very fast. Do people know how scales of N with the number of sheets of paper?
I think it's I think it has to be just linear.
You think it's just linear?
Yeah, I think it's maybe exponential, psychologically exponential. but in my psychology, whenever I was tearing phone books, I always thought it was linear.
I mean, it's just tearing one sheet at a time.
But you multiply.
Yeah.
Yeah. Phil, you stack it all together. Okay. Phil, you had a question.
I had a question about scales, but a different question. Are there length scales in the problem? I mean, what I'm a little worried about is the beginning. You say, well, I don't want to talk about crystals, I don't want to worry about dislocations and things. So Mike took a model with his big balls and little balls. Mm-hmm. Of course, that can crystallize too on a certain surface.
Oh, yeah, sure.
On a certain length scale.
Yeah.
And in real life, I'm always in between, I'm always in at least a partial crystalline system. So, are there natural...
Well, not if I take window glass and some top glass. Maybe correlation.
I mean, you see X-ray diffraction. I mean, there are spots.
You could have.
The question that I have is now you're talking about the radius of curvature. So there are the lengths. That was the only time I saw the scale in your talk. Was when you talked about the radius of curvature of the end of the tip. Are there length scales that I have to compare about with what goes on?
There are some length scales, sure. Obviously, you were already mentioning a length scale has to do with correlations. And there's clearly a length scale in that those amorphous materials, but we think that the way this is formed with a rapid crunch, it's just the molecular size there. But now you can think of other length scales. There's the surface tension in any of these things, because I have interactions between the particles, and the surface tension will itself convert itself into a length scale. And so it carries a length with it. Elasticity by itself is not necessarily going to have a length scale, but you can, in certain of the plastic laws, you can produce other kinds of length scales. Now, what we've tried to do in that analysis was to get rid of as many of those as we possibly could. We wanted the absolutely simplest thing so that we would have as little freedom as possible to adjust parameters and...
For example, in say Mike's simulation, suppose I changed all the... There's a length scale in the Leonard Jones. You use Leonard
Jones. That's right.
There's a length scale in there. Suppose I changed that by a factor of 5.
Well, that's
now,
simply...
Are
that,
no. Would it look exactly the same?
Yes, because after all, the spacing between the molecules, the natural spacing between the molecules is the minimum in the Leonard-Jones potential. So that's a completely arbitrary...
But when it gets small enough, if I made it very small, then I start having to worry about this question of the back and quantum flux. I'm trying to understand where things come,
Well, look, obviously, if I were talking about systems that were small enough so that the de Broglie wavelength of the molecules is an important length scale, I'd have to do something quite different. But you don't want me to do that.
No, but I'm just trying to understand how I could think about it. I mean, why can't I just think of the crack in an absolutely homogeneous isotropic medium or something?
Well, I can. I'd like to try doing that.
Without any graininess. I mean, to what extent is the graininess in the Leonard Jonesian play a role? I'm a little confused.
Okay. Produced a fixed point scale. You are.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
There's only one scale.
Because I didn't put it. Look, the only
in sort of this SDB model, would that come out if that stabilized the crust?
Look, the answer that I get out of those calculations, and I should have brought some of that in, comes out from dimensional analysis. Not there are very few parameters when I just do a simple plasticity theory. You see, the only length scale that I have available to me is a measure of the applied externally applied stress, I can even leave the surface, again, a reasonable answer leaving the surface tension out. So that, in fact, what's one of the very interesting aspects of it is that you can see immediately that the radius of curvature actually has to go to zero at the threshold. Because that's only if I leave surface tension out. That what I have to do is I have to put an infinitesimal amount of stored energy in the material, so I'm stretching my thing by a very little bit. I have to amplify that up to a yield stress, and there the yield stress is one of the things that will give me a scale. The only way I can amplify that up to the yield stress is by having an extremely sharp tip. And it's another one of those rather interesting features of these kinds of calculations that comes out only from purely from dimensional analysis is that as I push the thing harder, the tip is actually going to blunt and probably be, it could be another one of those possible explanations for some of these instabilities. That if I push it harder and it blunts enough, it could then, that may be one reason it wants to split. So, but well, you're pushing me hard now into areas of this which have not been explored yet in a sense of life. Phil, unless Tony wants me to quit. Phil, did you want?
Phil has a question.
Yeah?
Well, we'll get the plot back up again.
Which plot?
The last plot. This is why you're getting
the colored picture. Got to go back here. There's a little bit here. You can see pink regions in there that they're just some fluctuations, but remember that what you have to do to make these things go is you have to apply a jolly big tension. What you're doing here is you have to imagine this thing with boundaries way off there. And you're just pulling uniformly across the top and the bottom boundaries so that everything out here ahead of the crack is in tension, and that's the elastic energy that's being stored and being converted to essentially surface energy in here, plus everything that's dissipated.
Yeah, okay?
I usually, when I give this talk, talk more about the instabilities and draw a diagram of that experiment.
Okay, let's thank the speaker.
No, it's